John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick with you. Thanks for listening. We have a lot to get to on this Friday. Some self-reflection this hour. The GOP may have to take a good hard look at itself after Republicans in the House proved unable to pass a border bill on Thursday. One former Republican U.S. Senator, Robert Bennett of Utah, says Republican takeover of the Senate could actually increase the likelihood of a big deal on immigration. And because it's Friday, we've got our movie reviewers, and we're going to hear from actor James Franco later. But first, we hold up the mirror to the crisis erupting around the world from Syria to Gaza. A 72-hour ceasefire between Israeli forces and Palestinian militants that was supposed to start overnight lasted only a few hours. It remains unclear who broke the ceasefire, but reports have emerged that an Israeli soldier was abducted and 27 Palestinians were killed since the pause was put into effect. Hundreds of thousands in Gaza are now displaced. That number runs into the millions when you include the regional turmoil in Syria and Iraq, Lebanon, and Egypt. But our next guest says this is actually an opportune moment to put a stop to the suffering and end the violence. He's David Miliband. He served as British Foreign Secretary from 2007 until 2010 under Tony Blair. He's now president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee. David Miliband is here in studio with me. Mr. Secretary, welcome.
It's very good to be here.
Very good to have you. And I'd like to begin with the humanitarian moment in Gaza. What is your assessment? Obviously, violence rages on. We just mentioned that the ceasefire lasted only moments. What's your assessment of the humanitarian moment, and will it be possible anytime soon to get real relief to Gazans who probably have little to do with Hamas, who are suffering under the blockade and under war?
There's no question that there is an absolutely hellish situation in Gaza at the moment. All the reports from the United Nations and from some brave journalists who are reporting on the situation speak to tremendous levels of death and destruction. Obviously, overnight, there was a widespread hope that the ceasefire would hold, but the news that it's broken shows you the extent to which both sides are now caught in a spiral of violence in which the civilians of Gaza are actually ending up as the pawns. And Israel is obviously prosecuting a war against Hamas. The great danger is that on the anvil of that war are thousands of civilians, now 220,000 of them displaced from their homes in UN shelters and not even safe there. And that raises a very profound point, not just for me as the leader of a humanitarian organization, the International Rescue Committee now, but also as someone who's observed global politics, that the norms and laws that have been built up over centuries to defend civilians in war, sanctified in the Geneva Conventions after the Second World War, are being lost. And the absolutism that said civilians are protected in war, that there is a prohibition on the attacks on civilians as well as the use of civilians as quote-unquote human shields, this is a very retrograde and dangerous step.
That's only one aspect of things that we thought we know about war and about the Middle East being turned on its head in this conflict. Also, on the diplomatic level, if we take a step back, we seem to be in a moment where both Israel and Hamas feel isolated from their normal allies, their friends. Israel doesn't seem to be listening very closely to John Kerry and the United States. Hamas has its traditional ally in Egypt, and they are not talking at all. Many other Arab countries seem to not be by Hamas's side. If these two sides feel like they're isolated themselves, what incentive do they have to reach a settlement?
I think that the region is roiling in a very deep and dangerous way. However, it's striking that those who said 3 or 4 years ago that the so-called Arab Spring, the rising of Arab peoples against their governments in the name of more freedom and accountability, that this would isolate Israel, that isn't actually what's happened. I mean, in many ways, you can see the conflict in Gaza as being one where Egyptians, Saudis, others, far from rallying to the side of the Palestinians, are actually seeing Hamas, what they perceive to be one of the more militant wings of the Palestinian movement, crushed. And so it's a situation of enormous uncertainty where sides are shifting. And Egypt, obviously, a year ago, if we'd been speaking, would have been governed by Mr. Morsi, a leader representing the Muslim Brotherhood. They've been ousted. Egypt has strongly switched sides. And I think that the absolute key, if you're thinking about the Gaza situation, remember, I negotiated at the United Nations in 2008-09 the ceasefire that brought an end to that war in 2008.
And here we are again, yes.
And we're here again. And the fundamental point is that the Palestinian Authority, who runs the West Bank, run by Fatah, needs to get political control back in Gaza as well as in the West Bank. And on the other hand, the border crossings need to be open so that there's some life and livelihood for people in Gaza. I visited Gaza in 2011. It's 1.8 million people in an extremely crowded small piece of land. And that basic notion that there's political stability with people who are committed to negotiating with Israel, the Palestinian Authority, and on the other hand, relief and benefit for those who choose a peaceful path, being in the lives and the prosperity of the people who live there, never mind the peace and security, that is the fundamental deal. And the tragedy of 2009's ceasefire resolution is that neither the blocking of arms supplies into Gaza nor the opening of the crossings, which were demanded by the UN resolution, have been lived up to. And that's why you've ended up with this tinderbox that's been created today.
There's so much hand-wringing now about Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, who in the West Bank, who you say perhaps the Israelis should try to get closer to in order to isolate Hamas. A lot of people think that that's the only way forward. There's so much hand-wringing about what a weak politician Abbas has become that in a way it doesn't seem like even that moment is possible.
I think that hand-wringing is probably not the right word to use in the context where 1,500 people have been killed in the last 3 weeks. There is a grave sense that the prospects for the so-called two-state solution that many people, including myself, believe is the only basis for a long-term stability in the region is being lost. But it's also the case that as recently as April, Hamas was so weak that it had to offer Mahmoud Abbas the chance to come back into Gaza to run the place. It was ready to give up power. In fact, it offered to do so in the name of a so-called technocratic government. And the fact that that opportunity was not taken, we're paying the price of that today. So it's not a matter of whether Israel should snuggle up to the Palestinian Authority. It's that those who are committed to negotiate a stable solution need to be empowered and supported.
I'd like to move north of Gaza a little bit to another area, and unfortunately there are many to choose from, where a dire humanitarian crisis is interplaying with war and some terrible politics. In Syria, which you've written about recently, it seems that the world is quite rightly watching the Gaza situation very closely and focused on ISIS and the caliphate that it's establishing in Iraq. Also on jetliners going down in Ukraine, all giant stories. While that's all happening, a humanitarian conflagration of enormous proportions, absolutely horrific, has developed once again in Syria, and we're not really watching.
Well, you're right, I think, to draw attention to the fact that while the media rightly move on to quote-unquote the latest news, it's important that diplomacy keeps its attention on problems that may no longer be in the headlines. They may be on page 3 instead of page 1, but nonetheless, they are absolutely vital, not just to millions of people, but to the stability of the region. I mean, the scale of the implosion in Syria, a country of 22 million people, needs to be understood. 10 or 11 million have been displaced from their homes. 3 million are in neighboring countries, so 7 or 8 million displaced within the country. 60% of hospitals destroyed, 160,000 people killed. If I'd been on this show 3 years ago and said, I foresee this scale of destruction in Syria, something must be done. You'd have said, well, the world won't let that happen. Yet the world has let that happen. And the price is being paid in the short term by millions of civilians and by neighboring countries, including close allies of the United States, Jordan most obviously, that are bearing an extraordinary brunt of refugee flows. I mean, you know the debate here in the States about the unaccompanied children coming to the U.S., 60,000. Jordan has got 1 million refugees in a population of 6.5 million. I mean, that's like the whole of Britain coming to America for Jordan. So the scale of the suffering is very, very large. And the frustrating thing, Secretary Albright and I wrote a piece last week talking about this, the frustrating thing is that some of the easier things to do are not being done. Look, it's hard to bring peace to a situation where the Assad government thinks it's winning. But it's easier to address the humanitarian situation in the neighboring countries and for those poor civilians stuck in Syria in the crossfire of the fighting. And that's what we think it needs much more attention, or needs ongoing attention, as Secretary Kerry understandably has to address Ukraine or Gaza. We need ongoing attention to the crisis in Syria.
Now, you have written in that very article about how it's possible to leverage humanitarian crisis, not to leverage the crisis, but the response to the crisis, which traditionally countries have taken a pause to allow, to leverage that dynamic to get closer to a political solution.
What we're saying is that if you ignore the humanitarian crisis, it will have political consequences. And frankly, the rise of ISIS in part speaks to that. The vacuum on the humanitarian side in Syria has allowed the development of ISIS. I mean, my organization, the International Rescue Committee, is doing cross-border work into Syria. We're trying to help Syrians. For obvious reasons, we can't talk about it in great detail. But alongside us, there are a whole range of organizations, international but also local. Some of them are fighting as well as delivering social welfare. And incubated in that vacuum in Syria is ISIS, which has now broken through into Iraq. The point that Secretary Albright and I made is that tending to the humanitarian need can pave the way towards meaningful political engagement. And the evidence from other countries in the past, some of your listeners will remember Lifeline Sudan, that's an example where humanitarian effort and the negotiation of humanitarian effort brought temporary relief but also paved the way towards wider talking.
At the same time, we have to always talk about incentives. And you just mentioned the fact that it's hard to reach somebody like Bashar al-Assad when he thinks he's winning. What incentive does he have right now to allow more humanitarian effort that could pave this way? You're working over the border in other countries, but I don't see a great deal of incentive for him right now to cooperate with that.
You're right that he has less incentive than he did 18 months ago or 2 years ago. However, his incentives are set in part by the military situation on the ground, but also by the positions of his supporters, Russia and Iran, and the costs for them of this Syria conflict arising. And so he's subject to multiple pressures, external and internal. My point, as the leader of a humanitarian organization, is that for the world to have half measures or quarter measures or one-tenth measures for the civilians caught in this ghastly uncivil war in Syria is a very, very short-termist attitude with long-term consequences. And the implosion of a country as big as Syria in the heart of the Middle East has long-term consequences that we outside shouldn't think will not affect us.
David Miliband is president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee. He is also the former British Foreign Secretary under Tony Blair from 2007 until 2010. Mr. Secretary, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Leave my sister and my daughter!
Because I bloody well stammer!
Well, the weekend is nearly upon us, so let's talk about some big new movies. We're lucky, as always, to have our Movie Date team to guide us through the weekend's big new releases. Rafer Guzman is film critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi, Todd.
Kristen, your conversation with James Franco is going to be coming up in a couple of minutes. Now, together, Rafer and Kristen host the Movie Date podcast. Guys, first, let's do some trivia.
Okay.
I know you love this. Kristen, this question is not necessarily designed to defeat you.
I don't believe you.
So listen to the question. Don't answer yet. We're going to get the answer at the end. Today, we're going to be talking about Get On Up, a new biopic from James Brown. Dan Aykroyd co-stars in this film. He plays the agent, Ben Bart. Dan Aykroyd appeared with the real-life James Brown in a film. You're going to name that film. Don't answer yet. We'll come back to it. So, guys, let's get on to Get On Up. This is the James Brown biopic starring Chadwick Boseman.
If it sound good and it feel good, then it's musical. So play it like I say, play it. Hit it!
Oh, Kristen, I'm betting that this movie just has tons of great music. I think I'm already sold here.
Oh, the music's fantastic. And those performance scenes are just electrifying. Every time he's on stage, you just want to literally get on up and cheer. It's fantastic. However, the movie does suffer a little bit from the same ailment that a lot of biopics do. It doesn't always know where to narrow in. It tries to cover too much ground. And in this case, they jump back and forth in time way too much. And Chadwick Boseman is breaking the fourth wall a lot and talking to us, which kind of throws the whole tone of the movie off.
Rafer, are people going to be dancing in the aisles here?
Yeah, I mean, I think this has got a built-in fan base. Obviously, you know, baby boomers, people who love funk and soul and who love James Brown. I would say the movie more than suffers a little bit from the jumbled structure. It's completely disorganized, almost incoherent, and I found it actually really frustrating to try to get a handle on James Brown's very messy and you know, large life that he had in this wide career that he had. And the movie, I think, just makes a complete mess of it. And I found that really maddening.
Next is Guardians of the Galaxy. Now, look, I am predisposed to hate any comic book movie. I stay away from them. I'm in the minority, and a lot of people love them. Hey, it's why the studios make millions on them, so I know they're not listening to me. Guardians of the Galaxy, ensemble cast. We have Chris Pratt. We have Bradley Cooper, Lee Pace. Vin Diesel, thank God, is in it. John C. Reilly, Glenn Close. Lots of other people. Here's a clip.
I have part of a plan.
What percentage of a plan do you have?
You don't get to ask questions after the nonsense you pulled on Nowhere.
I just saved Quill.
We've already established that you destroying the ship that I'm on is not saving me.
When did we establish?
Like 3 seconds ago.
No, I wasn't listening. I was thinking of something else.
Oh.
Kristen.
Oh, I want to loudly exhale forever. When I think of this movie, oh, it is like the worst of being on a date with a 13-year-old boy all in one movie. It's just like hanging out with somebody who keeps quoting Monty Python and doing it badly. It's such cornball humor. It's not actually funny. The action is so-so. And it looked to me kind of shabby.
What do you think, Rafer?
I'm not a big fan of superhero movies either. I've been hating them for years, and this is the first one I would recommend to you, Todd. I think this is fresh, funny,
really?
Smart. It's got a rocking soundtrack. I think the humor is really clever. It's basically an ensemble action comedy. If you think of it that way and not as a sci-fi superhero film, I think you'll be really pleased.
All right, guys. Well, there's one vote for Guardians of the Galaxy. Let's do trivia before I let you go. Dan Aykroyd stars along with Chadwick Boseman in Get On Up, the James Brown story. Dan Aykroyd appeared with the real-life James Brown in a film. Name it, please.
Actually, it's two movies. That would be Blues Brothers and Blues Brothers 2000.
Do you see the light?
What light?
Have you seen the light?
Yes! Yes! I have seen the light!
Ooh, that's a point and a bonus point for Kristen Meinzer. It's a first.
I got it.
Thanks,
finally.
Guys. Kristen Meinzer, Takeaway Culture producer, and Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, our Movie Date team. Download the Movie Date podcast at moviedatepodcast.org. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Todd.
And now, one more thing from the Takeaway's Kristen Meinzer. She had a chance to sit down with James Franco and Scott Hayes to talk about their new film, Child of God. It's an adaptation of the Cormac McCarthy book by the same name, and it's directed by Franco. Now, the movie is a character study of Lester Ballard, played by Scott Hayes. Lester is living in isolation in rural Tennessee, and he spirals into a dark, twisted, crime-riddled existence. And Franco says he relied on subtle comedy to help audiences hang in with such a grim tale.
What I found out when I started adapting the book is that when you normally have a character like this, he is being tracked down by the detectives. Rarely do you have a character like this who is at the center of the film in such a prominent way. So my goal was not to make Lester sympathetic. In no way do I condone his behavior. But it's within the realm of art. And so for me, I'm not making a moralistic tale. I'm examining human behavior. And I'm using a monster to talk about more universal human things. But if I'm going to use a monster like this, I don't want to repel the audience. I want to shock them, but I want them to stay with us. I don't want them to kind of shut off emotionally from him. And comedy is such a powerful tool for bringing an audience onto the side of a character. It's just, you know, if an audience can laugh with a character, you've won them over.
This particular story, like a lot of Cormac McCarthy stories, is pretty dark and it's raw, and it's particularly difficult because it really only has one character who's carrying the whole movie. The whole weight is on your shoulders, Scott. You're playing Lester Ballard, the protagonist, and Lester does some things that I think a lot of people would consider pretty despicable. There's necrophilia, you're defecating on screen, you're throwing up, you're doing a lot of things, kidnapping bodies. Was it a challenge to try and create the right balance? Because you want this character in some way for people to keep on watching and not be so repulsed that they're going to turn away. So I'm curious, did you see this character, both of you, as somebody who we're supposed to identify with, somebody that we should look at as a warning, someone we should feel sorry for? How did you want this character to come across to people?
Cormac's writing is, it doesn't lend a lot of itself to the inner workings of what Lester's feeling. So a lot of times when I'm reading the novel is I would try to approach in the sense of just thinking about what is this man going through. And there's certain elements, I think, that are really at play of feeling really alone and wanting to connect and wanting to be loved and wanting to have a family. And I'm sure that he didn't want his father to commit suicide. He wanted to stay on the land, but he was ostracized from society, cast away, and wasn't shown love and never had a girlfriend. So I think in living that stuff out, those are human desires that I think every human has, is to want to feel connected or belong to a group or belong to a society. And that is something I wanted to convey. So it wasn't just, I'm going to kill this person because I need a body. It was, there's a need there. There's a desire. There's an obsession that's happening.
So, James, you've written books and screenplays. You're a painter, directing, acting. You do a lot of different things. And I think some people look at your career and think, what's going on? Is there an end goal in all of this? Do you have an end goal, something that you're aiming for in the end? Or do you just want to do as many things as humanly possible?
You know, we live in a postmodern age, and form is so fluid. And there's a weird thing where a lot of people are just stuck in these old ideas of a creative person needs to stay with one thing. I see form matching content. And so the goal is not to put one more feather in my cap each time I do something new. It's just to explore and to, by going to Brooklyn College and also going to film school and then also going to acting school, well, now I have, you know, three different approaches I can take on any given project. And it just makes me a more satisfied and more rounded artist.
That was Kristen Meinzer, Takeaway Culture producer and co-host of the Movie Date podcast, interviewing James Franco and Scott Hayes about their new film, Child of God, out in theaters this weekend. You know, all this week here at The Takeaway, we've been looking at some of the 36 Senate races heating up across the country. The stakes are high in the midterm elections in November. Republicans are feeling increasingly confident that they can win back control of the Senate, putting them in control of both houses of Congress. So the question, would a Republican Congress mean greater cooperation or more gridlock within a party that's increasingly divided? Robert Bennett is a former Republican U.S. senator from Utah and now a senior fellow at the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington. He thinks that if the Senate flips to Republicans this November, the gridlock Congress we become accustomed to might finally be able to start taking action.
This Congress has passed fewer bills than any in recent memory. This Congress makes the do-nothing 80th Congress that Harry Truman railed against look like a hotbed of activity. And the problem is not just ideological. The problem is the fact that the Senate is not taking any action. So, yeah, you will see a very different kind of Congress.
You think that tough issues like, let's take comprehensive immigration reform, which has been impossible to pass largely because of divisions among Republicans, although not exclusively, you're taking the view that big, tough issues with a lot of politics at stake might actually have a better chance after 2014 if Republicans take over?
Yes, I think they might. Now, it will not just be within the Congress. With a Republican leader like McConnell, President Obama can make a deal. Now, the president has got it in his head, maybe justifiably in the present circumstance, but the president has got it in his head that the Republicans are absolutely intractable and cannot be dealt with, and therefore he doesn't try to deal with them, and he spends his time demonizing them. Every speech he gives, regardless of the subject, turns around at the end to be an attack on how partisan the Republicans are and how terrible the Republicans are. As long as the president maintains that stance, why, nothing is going to change. But if the president looks over and says, okay, there is now a majority leader of the other party who, if I show a little bit of give, is willing to show a little bit of give on his part, maybe the time has come in these last 2 years for us to start to talk about these issues. Yeah, you can see some movement in it.
Senator, you just said that maybe a Republican Senate and a Republican Congress might lead to big, hard things more likely to get done because the president will be more motivated to make a deal. Let me play you a little bit of Senator Ted Cruz, a Republican from Texas. He was on Fox News Sunday.
What I want to do is solve the crisis. I agree with the president in one respect. We are seeing a humanitarian crisis. We are seeing tens of thousands of young children coming in illegally, being brutalized, being mistreated by global transnational drug cartels. And the cause of this crisis is the promise of amnesty.
Now, that's Senator Ted Cruz from Texas, of course, talking about the border crisis right now going on down in Texas. Senator Ted Cruz is helping to control House conservatives. Now, Ted Cruz is of an ilk that helped defeat you in your own primary in Utah. And it leads me to the question, you know, Barack Obama is only part of Mitch McConnell's problem. Even if Republicans take the Senate, Mitch McConnell still has to deal with these deep divisions in his own party.
Numerically, they are not that strong. Rhetorically, they are, and they make good headlines, and they get a lot of ink, and they get a lot of airtime. But the Senate did pass a comprehensive immigration reform bill, even without Republican control, with a lot of Republicans voting for it. There are enough votes to vote down the Ted Cruzes of the world in the Senate. The problem is the House on the immigration issue.
Won't the House be more emboldened if they see a Republican Senate? Won't they feel the need to challenge the Senate even more if it's controlled by establishment Republicans like Mitch McConnell and Orrin Hatch and the Robert Bennetts of the world?
Well, if I'd wanted to really understand the House, I guess I would have run for it. but you look at the 2014 cycle, and the Tea Party has not been anywhere near as successful in upending establishment Republicans in primaries as they were in 2012 and 2010. And you're beginning to see some of that in Speaker Boehner's demeanor. Yes, there was Eric Cantor, but Eric Cantor didn't lose because of the Tea Party. Eric Cantor lost because he ignored his constituents. He took the whole thing for granted. He was out sipping coffee when the Tea Party people were out knocking on doors. The political dynamic is swinging. The Senate candidates, you do not have the kinds of primary victories for the Tea Party in 2014 that you had in 2010 and 2012. There are enough Republicans in the House, I believe, who, if they see the Senate switch to the Republicans and they see the establishment senators firmly in control and they read the polls, pretty soon they'll say, you know, it isn't ordained in Scripture that we control the House. We could start to slip over here, and public opinion's pretty strong. And now you've got Republicans in the Senate saying, come on, guys, you need to shape up. You could see some changes.
Senator, I'm glad you mentioned Scripture, because we may be in a situation where Mitch McConnell is Moses. Republicans could take back the Senate. Mitch McConnell could lose in Kentucky and not get to go to the promised land.
That's true, and I think that would be a tragedy. He is poised, friendship aside, he is poised to deliver the kinds of changes I've been talking about. He has the background, he has the experience, he has the respect for the institution. Yes, there are others who could replace him. Nobody is irreplaceable. But he has the understanding of what has to be done to make the Senate function again better than anybody else. And to tip him over in Kentucky, even if there were enough Republicans to take control without him, I think would be a great loss.
Well, Mitch McConnell has to win in Kentucky for this dream to be realized fully for him. Senator Robert Bennett is a former United States senator from Utah and currently the senior fellow at the Bipartisan Policy Center, who says that Republican control of the Senate could lead to a big deal like on immigration reform. Senator, thank you.
Happy to talk to you.
You can see our interactive map of the 2014 Senate races to watch. It's all at thetakeaway.org.
It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good.
You know, it's the little things that we take for granted.
It was important for me not to look sick. I think it was important for me mentally to try to look my best.
I am not my body. I am my spiritual being. You know how I feel.
Three women there and their stories of breast cancer. It can become a mirror for a lifetime of self-examination and self-reflection.
It's funny because when I was younger, I have a scar on my face from a car accident that I was in. And, you know, I used to be, like, so insecure about the scar. As I got older, like, people would be like, what scar? They hadn't noticed it. And that's when I knew, like, it's all about how you feel about yourself. And a lot of people, they don't pay attention to those type of things. Those aren't the things that they notice about you first. So I feel like if I feel sexy, if I feel beautiful, other people usually feel that way about you.
Crystal Miller, 28 years old and battling breast cancer at a time when she should be living her life like every other 20-something in New York. She's one of the women we're profiling for our series Under Her Skin, Living with Breast Cancer, an intimate portrait of life as an African-American woman with the disease. We're a month into our six-month series with these women, and the conversation has turned to body image. Body image after chemotherapy, after surgery, after hair loss and radiation, and all of the things that come with a diagnosis. July 29th, 2014.
I don't feel like this has made me feel any less feminine than I was before, but it was something that I was concerned about in the beginning. And some of the ways that I made sure that I felt this way is by, looking at myself after surgery in the mirror and appreciating what I saw.
Anita Coleman in Los Angeles, July 31st, 2014.
For some strange reason, as my hair grows back, it is totally really doing its own thing. And nothing will hold it down. I mean, I look like alfalfa in one place. It would be on the verge of Pippi Longstocking if it kept growing that way. My hairs would be sticking out. So no, I will wear headbands, hats, wigs. But if my hair does not grow in completely, I'll still be okay because I can work around that.
Confronting a body changed by disease is something Anita has done before. She underwent reconstruction after her first battle with breast cancer in 2001.
The purpose of the reconstruction was to make me look like a woman, make me whole again. But little did I know I was already whole, and I have always been whole. But the journey had to take me to the place where I realized how whole I really was, because even after the reconstruction, I had to conquer the look. And when I say conquer the look, I look fine on the outside to the human eye, but I know what I saw in the mirror. I saw a lot of scars because I have had a lot of surgeries. Needless to say, my bikini cut has a couple frowns and ridges. But I'm okay with that because I had to learn I am still here.
But it's Lisa Eccles from Memphis who has undergone the most drastic change. July 22nd, 2014.
I had both breasts removed. With that, there is no natural breast tissue. So it has affected my body. But the thing is, it has not affected me and how I live from this point on.
Lisa underwent a bilateral mastectomy at the end of June. She's decided to go ahead with reconstruction, and she says her husband supports her.
You know, you have a choice now about having a reconstructed surgery to give you this sense of identity as a woman.
In our Under Her Skin Facebook group, there are lots of women with breast cancer sharing their stories. Jessie Miller from Frisco, Texas, told us she found herself in a very different situation after undergoing a double mastectomy. Two failed attempts at reconstruction left her in a dark place.
By July of 2011, I was completely flat, healing. I had a hard time for about a year after that to look at myself in the mirror and not just see the scars. That was pretty much all I saw.
But where she once saw scars, Jessie now sees a survivor.
Breast cancer does not have to define who you are. In the end, it's just how you feel about yourself am right now. I feel so wonderful about where I am right now. I got through it, and the image I see now of myself is not the scarred person that I was, but a beautiful survivor who can get through anything in their life.
I was diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer in August 2013, had bilateral nipple sparing mastectomy a month later, reconstruction surgery in April 2014.
That's Silke Pfluger from Los Gatos, California. She wrote us in our Facebook group on July 17th, 2014, and the story she shares is one of hope.
I'm skinnier, I'm healthier, and I'm happier than I ever was. I've always worked out, but now I work out a lot, and it shows, and I feel great. Also because I lost 30 pounds and because I have beautiful new boobs. My husband even called me one day on his way to work to tell me how beautiful I am. That's not something he's ever, ever done. He's a German and they don't do that. There'll always be the fear that it'll come back, but I'm determined to enjoy every bit of my life in the meantime, and I'm feeling good and I'm really looking good.
I believe that if you strip off the skin, we're all the same up underneath.
A final thought now from Anita Coleman, July 31st, 2014.
You keep living, you're going to get a little pouch, you're going to get some love handles, but you still are the same person. You're still that beautiful being. And to find yourself knowing that you are beautiful regardless to what you look like, I want to be considered and remembered by the person I am, not how I look.
And I'm feeling good.
For these women, it's not about surviving, it's about living. We want to thank Lisa and Anita and Crystal and you who've been brave enough to share your thoughts and your fears with us. We want you to join our Facebook group, whether you're someone who's been diagnosed with breast cancer or not. We want to invite you into this conversation. Just go to Facebook.com and type in Under Her Skin. You can visit us at thetakeaway.org/series/breastcancer to find interviews and entries from our guests' audio diaries, and more information about how you can take part.
And I'm feeling good.
Hi, this is Sarah Thornton. I'm an artist from Minneapolis. During my teenage years, I wanted to disappear through thinness. I wouldn't eat well, and I would run a lot every day. Conflicts at home and a lack of support system contributed to that. As I grew up, I found passions that I wanted to pursue with the energy and strength that I needed, and I slowly reclaimed my space, both physically and mentally.
This is Nikki from Kirkland, Washington. For me, having a baby was a game changer with my weight issues. So while most of my friends began having weight trouble after childbirth, for me, carrying my daughter made me tune into my own body's needs like never before. And at 54, worrying about weight is the last thing on my mind.
And we got this from Florida. One of my best friends is constantly telling me that I am short. I've grown to deeply dislike her, and I ended up not going to her wedding, and she isn't talking to me. Comments about my height were just the beginning. I cannot seem to forget every single statement she's made about my image. I remember almost every single statement, and I can't forget them or even let it go. Stories from you about confronting your body image. Share your stories with us at 8778-MY-TAKE. Thank you so much for listening. Todd Zwillick with you. John Hockenberry will be back on Monday. This is The Takeaway.
You know what I mean? Sleep in peace when day is done. That's what I mean. And this old world.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.